Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, March 2nd, our first show in Women's History Month. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the program, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
If you went to sleep on Friday thinking that tensions with Iran would simmer, by Saturday midday, the world had shifted. Iran's supreme leader is dead. U.S. and Israeli strikes have hit more than 2,000 targets in Iran, and Iran is firing back. American service members have already been killed, and President Trump says this will continue for 5 or 6 weeks or as long as necessary. This morning, the Pentagon briefed lawmakers and the American people with updates on the strikes in Iran. But there are so many questions swirling, including what the response from Congress could be. So much to talk about. And this hour, we'll unpack what happened, what it means, and whether the United States just entered another open-ended war in the Middle East. We have a reporter who is based in the Middle East who will spend some time with us. We'll also hear from journalists covering national security issues and defense. And we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. What is your reaction to the U.S. attack on Iran? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat. A lot to talk about today.
A lot to talk about. And of course, we ask for your reactions. But if you just have questions.
Yeah.
This is a confusing time for a lot of us. If you just have questions, we'll have experts here today. We'll have reporters who have been covering this conflict and others like it for a long, long time. You can get those questions in as well to studio2@whyy.org or the number 888-477-9499.
Trio of news stories this morning, Avi?
Yeah, and we start with sort of a good news, bad news story here. So here's the good news. Yet again, Philadelphia's homicide rate appears to be plummeting. There have been 16 murders in the city this year, according to police. That is down an astounding 51% from the same time last year. And last year, if you'll recall, Philly had the fewest murders in decades. So that means we're way down from what was already a historic low. There is an important caveat, however. The number of domestic violence homicides actually rose last year from 28 to 37. The Inquirer has a story today about how the PPD is attempting to reverse that trend by expanding a unit that will look to identify and support victims of abuse. The unit has 10 victim advocates and will soon add 10 sworn officers with training in this area. And the idea is to quickly, and that's the key word here, quickly support people in life-threatening situations, connect them to resources, help them map out a safety plan, and more.
Yeah, I do have a lot of questions. I wonder what has sort of happened over the past couple of years to make the numbers of domestic violence homicides go up as other forms of murder are going down. And according to the Inquirer, this is a national problem. There was an FBI report that came out last month that said the percentage of violent crimes within domestic violence relationships actually increased every year across the country between 2020 and 2024, with 75% of the victims being women. And so there's a lot of complex factors to go into why this happens, but it's a red flag. And I did a quick Google search and you saw this happening, you know, in all sorts of parts of Texas, Florida, Wisconsin, all sort of sounding the alarm that the number of domestic violence deaths has gone up.
But circling back to the first part of that news,
yeah,
because the police are, you know, thankfully dealing with fewer homicide investigations, there's more resources to commit to other areas.
And that's a positive
thing. And to, you know, focus more specifically on this area. And it's the reverse of what we saw a few years ago. There was this sort of compounding crisis where there were so many homicides and there was no time to investigate them, which created more cycles of violence, which created more homicides. Thankfully, we're now in sort of the reverse trend
that they
of
can,
that trend.
Yeah, and they can hone in on this.
They can hone in on something like this. So that's something that's positive to take away from all this. And it just goes back to what still is one of the more astounding crime trends of my lifetime, which is this crazy spike in homicides in and around the pandemic, followed by this crazy decline that is still continuing. And I still don't think we have our arms around exactly why.
Yeah. So interesting. So interesting. Another story that caught our eye, Pennsylvania hemp farmers could fall victim to the federal war on THC-laced drinks. Not sure if you've ever heard of the beverages Euphoria or Cycling Frog or Breeze.
What?
Yeah. These are
Cycling Frog, Breeze, and Breeze. Euphoria?
Yeah.
Wasn't that a show on HBO?
It was. Euphoria was a show. These beverages are basically drinkable cannabis.
It's a trademark lawsuit waiting to happen. Go ahead. Sorry.
The beverages are basically drinkable cannabis products containing hemp-derived THC. And according to advertisements, they're designed to offer a smoke-free, social, and fast-acting alternative to alcohol. And these drinks are part of a multi-billion dollar low-dose THC industry, which includes vapes and beverages and edibles like gummies and CBD, chews, and more. But in November, the federal government cracked down on this segment of the cannabis market by redefining what hemp means. And under a measure signed by Congress, now, low-dose THC products could become illegal and banned by the end of this year.
So they're closing the loophole.
They're closing this loophole. And this has a lot of our hemp farmers and folks who work in the hemp industry in Pennsylvania sounding the alarm, because this industry generates just under $1 billion in the Commonwealth and has about 10,000 people working in this area. And so hemp farmers are pushing lawmakers to regulate this industry at the state level or to stop the ban at the federal level because they want to preserve those jobs. And one idea, one proposal that's circulating is to create a cannabis control board, kind of like the liquor control board and the gaming control board, to sort of deal with
in
this issue. Yeah, in Pennsylvania to deal with this issue. But it's unclear. Even if Pennsylvania were to regulate it, if the feds don't change things, that industry could be wiped out.
Shout out, by the way, to the Inquirer, Henry Savage, who has been covering this issue for a while. You know, I'm not a betting man, but in a state where they have not legalized cannabis, I would be skeptical of the possibility of the state passing some sort of law to allow, you know, hemp products, THC-derived hemp products to remain on the shelves. That just seems like a long shot. Obviously, you feel for the hemp farmers and the folks who've invested, but they must have known from the outset that this was a risky investment because it was all predicated on a federal loophole that could always be closed. Now it's being closed.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the risk reward of investing in an area like this where it is so legally tenuous. And it's been for a long time. And I guess they were hoping they would establish the industry and then people would say, oh, it's too big or too established to get rid of. But that doesn't seem to be the direction it's heading right now.
And they've been making a lot, billions of dollars in this industry. I was actually inundated with Breeze commercials. And Breeze has THC and mushrooms infused in the beverage. It's supposed to make you feel euphoria when you drink it.
You were bombarded with ads.
With ads on social
media. So that's why you're drinking it right now.
I don't drink it. But I'm just saying, I was bombarded with ads. And I was like, what? Is this legal?
Just want to make sure there's water in that cup, right?
That is
okay,
water.
Just want to make
but
sure.
But I wondered if it was legal. And clearly, you know, a lot of people started asking questions when it blew up over the summer.
Speaking of asking questions, I got a lot of questions about story number three. Customs and Border Patrol agents at Philadelphia International Airport have seized a shipment of ancient swords and arrowheads. You heard me right. So according to our news partner 6ABC, these old weapons were actually discovered back in October. They arrived from the UAE, but it actually took months for a local archaeologist to verify what they were. And it turns out they were very likely smuggled cultural artifacts dating from around 1600 to 1000 BCE. And they likely originate from an area near the Caspian Sea in Iran. And people think they were dug out illegally from ancient burial sites. And they were discovered just in a shipment of cargo at Philadelphia International Airport. And it's now kind of unclear what's going to happen to this large collection of ancient swords.
Yeah, it's so interesting. A former FBI stolen art investigator told 6ABC that this discovery underscores the scale of a global black market for stolen antiquities. Who knew? And apparently the objects of this size and age could go for a lot of dough, like six figures easily, just one item.
Also, it makes me wonder, how do I put this? Do smugglers think it's that easy? They're just putting it in shipments through the Philadelphia International Airport and hoping no one will open the box?
And
they're
like,
huge. Yeah, they're massive.
And they're made of metal. Is that how smuggling
works?
I think.
It's that easy? There's a lot of hubris wrapped into, up into this operation, I would think.
And there were a lot of arrowheads and swords, and the fact that, and they got caught. So yeah, they got clearly caught. They didn't do a good job.
Not good smugglers.
No.
There is a political dimension to this, because we have agreements with lots of countries around the world to repatriate items like this, but we don't have one of those agreements with Iran. You might have already guessed why. We don't have a great relationship with Iran. That is a country. We are currently bombing in alliance with Israel. We're going to talk about that ongoing operation on today's show with a couple of experts, and we want to hear from you as well. What's your reaction to the U.S. military intervention in Iran? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, the conflict between the U.S. and Iran is escalating as the Trump administration deploys more forces to the region and says we're still in, quote, early stages. This comes after U.S. and Israeli military attacks over the weekend killed Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and destroyed key targets of his oppressive regime. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke about the action this morning at the Pentagon.
We didn't start this war, but under President Trump, we are finishing it. Their war on Americans has become our retribution against their Ayatollah and his death cult.
The Islamic regime has responded with retaliatory action in the Middle East, targeting mostly U.S. military bases across the region. The escalations have claimed 4 U.S. lives so far, according to military officials. The endgame for the U.S. and Israel remains unclear. Will the attacks result in the regime change the majority of Iranians want? And what kind of timeline is the Trump administration willing to work on?
Lawmakers in D.C. are divided over this weekend's events. Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman is one of a few Democrats vocally defending the president's actions. Here he is on CNN talking about the death of the Supreme Leader.
This was an incredibly, incredibly precise and successful strikes, and they eliminated most of the leadership. So here we are. So yes, I do support that. You know, why can't the entire world celebrate that he's dead for what he's done to the world?
Joining us now to discuss are Nick Pelham, The Economist's Middle East correspondent, and Alex Ward, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nick, Alex, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Happy to be here.
And our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, we want to get your take. What is your reaction to the U.S. attack on Iran? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the chat.
I wanted to start with you, Nick. We widely expected some sort of military intervention in the hours leading up to this weekend. But what has surprised you so far about either the attack itself from U.S. and from the U.S. and Israel, or the response from Iran?
I mean, you're absolutely right. The Americans and Israelis signposted their readiness for an attack. It looked as if Iran was also preparing. It had nominated and designated people who could stand in place of those that expected to be assassinated. I think what surprised me most have been two things. One was the decision of Ali Khamenei, having prepared so much for his succession, to stay in place. In the summer war, if you remember, he went into hiding. This time he stayed in his bait in his court, and it seemed that he was prepared for a strike and prepared for his death and prepared to go down in the eyes of his followers as a martyr. And I think, you know, we'd all been expecting that he would disappear into hiding, and that somehow when he went, the regime would fall. And actually, what's happened, I think, is that his martyrdom has given new life to the regime. That's one thing that surprised. The other is just the extent, the escalation, the acceleration into a regional war. The targets aren't just American bases on the Iranian side. They're hotels, they're oil installations. They've closed the Straits of Hormuz. They're striking high rises. Civilians are very much in harm's way, and the message seems to be to the region that if we're going down, you're coming down with us, and to the world, you're going to have a very high price to pay for whatever happens in Iran.
I just want to clarify something you said there, Nick. You believe, and this is just your analysis, that the Supreme Leader wanted to die because he felt it gave the movement a better chance of succeeding him?
What it did, it was to re-energize the sort of the notion of martyrdom in Shia Islam. And you have to remember that the bulk of his followers are those who are ideologues who are steeped in Shia tradition. And at a time when kind of there'd been this massive sort of loss of faith inside Iran, when you have protesters on the streets calling for the death of the dictator, absolute abhorrence of the methods that the regime had used to slaughter its own population to suppress those protests. There seemed to be a kind of a process of transition underway inside Iran. And instead, what has happened is that the regime has got a new lease of life by focusing everything, instead of being on the thousands of protesters that were killed, focusing on the death of Ali Khamenei and his followers. And it's sort of shifted the agenda inside Iran. It's given, and it's sort of revived memories of the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, don't forget, this was a regime that sent hundreds of thousands of Iranians to their death based on the notion of martyrdom. And in fact, the kind of last thing that Ali Khamenei said to his followers before the war struck, just sort of days ahead of the war, was an appeal based on that of, and this here gets into some sort of Shia theology, but the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Hussein, refused to submit to Yazid. He died on the battlefield with, he was vastly outnumbered, died on the battlefield with his family. And that is sort of that icon has gone into motivating his followers. So essentially, what Khamenei was trying to do was to evoke the memory of Hussein. And he said, I will not submit to Yazid, clearly saying that he would not submit to America and its demands for capitulation.
Yeah, before we talk about the American rationale for these strikes and the response, Nick, I wanted to sort of ask you what is happening? What has been the reaction in Iran on the ground, and what's happening right now there, now that the Supreme Leader is dead?
I mean, all of this has to be caveated with the fact that Iran is still in an internet blackout. It's very hard to maintain communications. Phone lines are still open in some cases. Some people still do have internet access, but the bulk of the people, who before were communicating with the outside world don't and find it very hard to do so. But at the moment, from what we can gather, that expectation that the people would rise up, the call by both Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump for the population to take the fate of Iran into their own hands hasn't happened. Instead, the people who are filling the streets are those of the followers of Ali Khamenei. Instead of kind of protests and a demand to topple the regime, what you're seeing are people mourning for his death. That's what you're seeing on the airwaves. That's what you're seeing in the mosques. And it's very much the street at the moment seems to be dominated by the followers of Khamenei and not by his opposition.
Yeah. And so, Alex, I wanted to sort of bring you into the conversation, and what we heard, some of us may have heard some of the briefing that took place this morning from the Pentagon. What has been the main rationale that Pentagon leaders have given for why this strike and why the killing of the Supreme Leader was necessary?
Well, now the messaging is revolving around the fact that Iran posed some sort of imminent threat to the United States, that they were about a week or so away from nuclear breakout, that the Iranians had made some sort of decision to create an intercontinental ballistic missile that could hit the United States, and of course had missiles that could hit allies in Europe and throughout the Middle East. And if there were support for proxies, they'd be targeting Americans at any point that they wanted. And so, and then it's kind of morphed into they were developing nuclear weapons and their missile shield would somehow protect them from getting that nuclear capability, and then the U.S. would have no ability to stop them. We should note that this is a relatively new and growing argument. This all really started, I mean, there's a lot of points we could point to, but for this particular case, in January, there were protests against the regime that President Trump promised he would follow through on that. He would follow through with strikes to protect them. He didn't. Instead, amassing a military force in order to be able to pull off this kind of assault, which he's doing now. In the meantime, there was diplomacy over the nuclear aspects and making tons of signals to Tehran that if they just dismantled their nuclear program and perhaps also their missile program, all would be well. And then it grew into 5 decades of grievances between the U.S. and Iran, in which we should note the Iranians have killed Americans and service members throughout this time. And so it's now morphed into a kind of, you know, not, it's not the Iraq war, but the messaging is basically this is an evil regime. They've been attacking civilization. This is now a government, a regime that needed to be wiped off the face of the earth. And we're now hearing odd things about what the administration wants. They've been all over the place about whether this is full regime change or whether the U.S. would be fine if there was some leader in Tehran who could work with the U.S., like Venezuela's Delcy Rodriguez, who used to be in the Maduro regime there. It's unclear what the end game is here, other than the U.S. just wants to crush Iranian leadership, and this can keep going for 4 to 5 weeks.
Let me bring in a caller now. This is Melissa from Philadelphia, who's on the line. Melissa, you're on Studio 2. What is your question, comment, or insight?
I kind of just had a little bit of a comment to make. I feel like what Trump is doing is similar to what Netanyahu did over with the Palestinians. He's starting a war to hold his position in power. And instead of being civil and actually having evidence and investigating things the American way, he's doing things his own way and not allowing Congress to have a say in if we are ready to go into a war, if we want to go into this war, because there's no actual imminent threat. Everything is just, it could happen. They could have the capabilities. So there's really no threat to us. And we're getting involved in Israel's own issues, again, based on their own biases and their own disgusting ideologies of what Muslims and Palestinians are or not worth.
Thank you, Melissa. Yeah. Let's talk about Congress, Alex Ward. It feels like Groundhog Day, right? This is, I think, the ninth or so major strike of Trump 2.0 across 7 different countries. Every time it happens, there's a familiar cast of characters, almost all Democrats on Capitol Hill say this is illegal. It should have been this should have been greenlit by Congress. I try to pass some sort of resolution. It's not veto proof. End of story. Any reason this is going to be different this time around, Alex Ward, or are we just going to do the same play all over again and go through the motions of some people in Congress saying this is illegal and ultimately Congress doing nothing?
We're going to go through the motions. I mean, the war's also begun. So say somehow this all passed Congress and it was veto proof. Do we imagine President Trump is going to stop? I don't imagine that he will. He's already signaling this is going to go for a while. Now, it was interesting that you've had some members of the administration, but more particularly outside allies, including some lawmakers, say, well, this isn't a war. This is, an attack on the regime. But right. Just this morning, we heard Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth call it a war. But he just said it's not a war of regime change, even though the regime has changed. That's just it's a hard square to circle. But this is now a war. The administration is saying it is. Congress is constitutionally supposed to be the one to declare it. But let's not just, say this is on the Trump administration. 4 decades now, Congress has, through Republican and Democratic administrations, basically passed the buck on congressional war authorizations, effectively granting a lot of these powers to the president. And the president, of course, has welcomed those powers. So, Congress is trying to assert itself. That's all well and good. But they've I've ceded enough authority now that it's hard to put that genie back in the bottle.
Yep.
Because I wonder, Alex, Alex, quick follow-up. Even if they're able to cobble together enough votes to get a resolution passed, the president could just veto it. So it's like, what is the point politically of even passing a resolution? Could you talk through that? Like, do they have any real chance of doing it and overcoming a veto?
No, it doesn't seem like it. And we should know there are a ton of Democrats who've wanted to see strikes on Iran for quite some time. This is not a solely Trump administration or Republican point. It's fairly bipartisan. But on this point, the issue becomes, was this war wise? Is there a good end game here? Is there anything that can be accomplished that makes sense for the resources that the U.S. is expending? That I think Democrats have an issue with. And we should note that this is also political signaling, right? It'll be mostly Democrats who vote against. There's midterms coming up. And Democrats are effectively projecting that Americans will turn against this war, as there are expectations it could get worse, right? There could be regional escalation, as we're already seeing Iranians strike countries in the region, and they might be returning fire at some point soon. There will potentially be a power vacuum in Iran. There could be a civil war in Iran. Who knows? Or you know, there could be Iranian elites and authorities firing on protesters yet again if they come back onto the streets. So if this gets bad and U.S. resources continue to be expended in this, as President Trump says, it could be 4 or 5 or even weeks or even longer, Democrats might be betting that this war, which is where the poll numbers do not already look good for Trump, could get even worse, and that this could become a wedge issue not only in the midterm election but perhaps in the presidential election if we see, say, Secretary of State Marco Rubio or Vice President J.D. Vance vie for the Republican nomination.
And based on the polling we've seen so far, support for this strike seems to be in the low 20s among Americans. Let's bring in another caller. This is Glenn from Williamstown, New Jersey, on line 6. Glenn, you're on Studio 2. What's your comment?
Yes, thank you very much. It's very much follow-up to your last caller as well, in that the imminent threat here is very debatable, and you've been talking about Groundhog Day. Remember, there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and that was the whole precedent of Bush to go in there. I also think that using the word diplomacy in any of this and failure of diplomacy, you can't even use diplomacy. The Trump regime does not know diplomacy. They are full of coercion and intimidation with an ulterior motive, cannot be trusted. The war powers need to rein this president in. He cannot continue going off. And my final comment here, keeping it brief, just prior to this show was talking about Taiwan and China invading Taiwan and comparing it to Ukraine and Russia invading Ukraine. What kind of precedent have we set? You have to start comparing China to Taiwan with the United States and the actions that we are unilaterally taking around the world. Mm-hmm. It is to the detriment of everybody.
Thank you so much, Glenn. Speaking of unilateral, look, Israel is also involved here, but I think it's notable, Nick, that Europe is not all that involved. The other thing that you noted at the top of the show, you were surprised about the Iranian strikes on some of the Gulf states. Taking those two issues, sort of one and two, what do you make of the fact that Europe doesn't seem to be all that involved in planning and execution here? And what do you think will be the consequences of the Iranian strikes on the Gulf states in the region? Does that move them further into the U.S. camp as allies, or does it isolate them from the U.S. as they blame the U.S. for getting them deeper into this mess? So your thoughts on both of those, Nick.
When it comes to the Europeans, I think they're not united camp. There are signs that some European countries are coming into the defense of Gulf states. It's striking that while there have been amongst Gulf states, they feel that the Americans have not provided the sort of protection that they provided Israel. There have been a lot of strikes coming from Iran on their key installations. And I think that they're deeply concerned about where this is going. They didn't want the war to happen. You had the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, repeatedly called Donald Trump and urge him not to go to war. However, now that they're in this war and they've become the sort of the soft target that the Iranians are striking, I think they want it over and done with as quickly as possible. And there are signs, I think, that some Gulf states are coming, saying to the Americans, you got us into this mess, you've got to get us out. And end this regime. There may be others who are saying, just for God's sake, please stop any more carnage. We're going to, you know, you're damaging the notion that these Gulf states, Dubai was a safe haven where the world could do business in a really troubled region. You know, very much these Gulf states that had looked immune to the regional conflicts are now being dragged into them. They look like much of the rest of the Middle East. So if this war doesn't end soon, they're going to be paying a really heavy price. The Europeans, I think there are signs there again that the Iranians are dragging them in. There was a strike on Cyprus, where Britain has a military base, and Cyprus is a member of Europe, member of NATO, and that could end up bringing Britain in. Britain has already said that it would allow one of the bases on one of the islands that it has in the Pacific to be used for by the United States to strike Iran. There are signs that both the British and the French are sending equipment to try and bolster their defenses of Gulf states. Against that, you've got to have the look at the Spanish, who, as I understand it from a report that I just saw, telling the Americans that they cannot use their territory, the military bases on their territory for strikes on Iran. Mm. So there's deep nervousness about a kind of war, which I think is seen as being not compatible with international law. And the concern in Europe is that they could be party to that. And I think they're doing their utmost to stay out of it.
Yeah. Well, we have to say goodbye now to Alex Ward, who's a national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for your time today, Alex. I know you're incredibly busy. Appreciate your insights on Studio 2.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Nick is going to stick with us on the other side of this break. We're going to bring in another guest. And let's bring in one more caller before we get to this break. On line eight, we have Karina from Chestnut Hill. I have about 45 seconds. Karina, what's your insight as we get ready to hit this break?
Hi. I was just really concerned about how this action sets us up for grounds for creating and cultivating radicalization against this country, sort of as we saw September 11th. Where did those folks come from? Where did they get those ideas? As somebody that was there that day and lost somebody very close to me, I was angry, but also like, let's look to where did this come from, and how is the U.S. and their actions really going to bring us into the future, and we will see this come back again.
Thank you so much. And we do have to go to a break, Karina, but first, sorry for your loss, and also thank you for that question. We'll get to it on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. This hour, we're analyzing the unfolding conflict with Iran and the potential consequences for Americans at home and abroad. With us this hour is Nick Pelham, The Economist's Middle East correspondent. And now joining us is Jack Detch, defense reporter for Politico. Jack, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Good to be here.
And for you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, our phone line and inboxes are open. We'd love to hear from you. What is your reaction to the U.S. attack on Iran? You can email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. Or for streamers on YouTube or Facebook, put your comments in the chat. I'm going to read a couple comments. We got one from Kate from New Jersey, who says, I am ashamed of the human race. We have lost our souls. They talk about it like it's a board game. Sean says, it saddens me to see more lawless behavior from the U.S. and Israel. All this disregard for international law can only go on for so long before other countries act on these precedents. Only Congress should be able to call for war. Trump and Netanyahu are putting us all in danger. And I wanted to ask you, Jack, I mean, the president has said that he expects the U.S. strikes against Iran to last 4 to 5 weeks. And I want to get your take. Does this sound realistic, given the fact that the supreme leader in Iran is dead and it's unclear who will be in charge there?
Well, we're already hearing the administration backpedal from the four-week timeline today. We heard Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, say this isn't a single overnight operation. Trump himself told Jake Tapper the big wave hasn't even happened. The big wave is the one that's coming soon. So we're expecting more offensive operations from the U.S. here. It seems like the focal point has been on regime change. We don't know what's coming next. Trump has been very clear. He doesn't know what's coming next. So we see these varied and shifting explanations from the administration. Of course, they're going to be forced to put a finer point on it this week when there's a war powers vote in Congress.
Jack, I guess we have questions from our listeners about the consequences of this on a couple different vectors. The one before the break was how this impacts American or anti-American sentiment abroad. Do you think this has the possibility to supercharge anti-American sentiment in the Middle East and elsewhere?
What we've seen is sort of a splitting of traditional U.S. alliances. And of course, this goes back to the kerfuffle over Greenland back in January. You've had the situation in Ukraine, which the Trump administration has backed off of what was traditionally strong U.S. support. Now we see a variety of operations, Venezuela, Iran. You've seen some nations back up behind the administration, Ukraine specifically, seeming to say this is a very good thing. We see other allies of the administration kind of coming up with some defensive operations. But I think we do sort of see a shift in the traditional landscape and the U.S. very much going unilaterally here. You didn't see the administration do the traditional act of at least trying to rally the allies, as we saw with both Iraq wars, with the elder Bush and the younger Bush. That was not an approach the administration took here.
And what about the precedent it sets for other countries around the world? A lot of people bring up the specter of China and Taiwan. Look, Russia's already invaded Ukraine, so I'm not sure what more they could wring out of this precedent. But do you think other countries around the world are watching and learning from the U.S. example here and are preparing on some level to do versions of this elsewhere in the world?
Well, this is a unique operation, and some of the capabilities that the United States and Israel bring here militarily would be difficult to replicate by any nation, China and Russia perhaps an aside. But I mean, certainly, I think we do see a different context in the international landscape after Russia's war in Ukraine. We see the U.S. Acting more freely with a more free hand when it comes to operations like Venezuela, here in Iran, where we haven't seen a strong legal pretext being established. We've just seen sort of a public case, but not even a clear public case being made and shifting arguments from the administration. So it's possible we could see China latch on to something like this. But that's been in sort of the back of their heads for a long time, that it's key to Chinese national pride to undertake some sort of unification. So it's unclear whether that's going to have an impact.
Let's bring in another caller. We have Stephen from Ballot Kenwood on the line. Stephen, you're on Studio 2. What's your comment? Stephen? We lost Stephen from Ballot Kenwood. Let's go to Matthew from Willow Grove on the line. Matthew, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Real quickly, just wondering if you could talk about if this action that the president took actually falls under the War Powers Resolution. Does it fall under the president having 60 days to operate plus a withdrawal period? And also, maybe if we could talk a little bit about what constitutes a war, defining that between a military action.
Great questions. Thank you, Matthew from Willow Grove. Jack, could you comment on this, just sort of the War Powers Resolution versus the power that the president has that would trigger that 60 days versus an actual, what he would need to do to get an actual declaration of war? Your thoughts on that.
Well, still only Congress has the ability to authorize or declare war. So we're looking at the potential of a War Powers Resolution later this week, being led by Thomas Massie and Ro Khanna, as well as, of course, in the Senate by Tim Kaine. What the administration seems to be trying to say is this is an ongoing operation. They're trying to say it falls short of war, perhaps because of the scale, also perhaps because this is an operation that's an air operation, predominantly air and missile operation. It doesn't include boots on the ground, but it's important to note the administration today not ruling out the possibility of boots on the ground. That would seemingly change the context very significantly. And of course, I think you see a lot of reaction within Congress. People just aren't buying the idea that it's not war. I've been talking to senators throughout the weekend, including Senator Andy Kim. He said, look, Trump has said the word war. He said it with regards to casualties. He chose this war and called it a war. So it doesn't seem like this explanation is necessarily going to fly, at least on both sides of the aisle.
At what point, Jack, does this administration need to really sell this to the American people? I mean, the Trump administration, the president has really low numbers right now, and he's entering into this conflict in the Middle East. And just sort of at what point will he have to get some type of approval or some type of buy-in from the American people if he wants to continue to move forward?
I think we've passed that point. We saw a snap CNN poll this morning that 59% of the public is against this. We saw about 75%, at least ahead of the Venezuela operation, against that. So it seems like the president is somewhat vulnerable to this argument that's being made by Democrats, that he's distracted from the issues of affordability, of rising costs, of inflation, and more focused on foreign adventures. It doesn't seem to be going down well with all of Trump's MAGA base. Of course, former MAGA folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene have voiced their opposition to this. So this does leave the president perhaps vulnerable among independents, vulnerable on the midterms, and perhaps vulnerable among some of his own base that really pushed the idea that Trump wasn't going to start foreign wars. And here you have this massive military action against Iran.
Yeah. Nick Pelham from The Economist, thanks for standing by listening to all this. Wanted to get you back in the conversation because we've talked about sort of the shifting end goals and rationales of the U.S. here. We haven't really talked about what the strategy is for the regime in Iran and sort of what's their survival strategy. And is there an end game beyond survival here? So I was hoping you can address both of those things. Is the goal here for the regime just to survive? And if so, how do they do that? And secondly, is there sort of a day after scenario here for the regime as well?
I think in part they're trying to show that that they still are a regime. I think you have to remember that kind of what brought Trump into this was the notion that if you could decapitate Khamenei, you would bring down the regime. When they went for Gaddafi and got him out of Tripoli, and you know, the regime collapsed. When they went for Saddam Hussein and got him off his perch, the regime collapsed. Assad fled his country, the regime collapsed. And yet this seems to be very different. You've got
And why is it different, Nick? Yeah. I want you to explain that to our listeners. What we've heard from many corners, there's more of an ideological underpinning to this regime or this movement that perhaps didn't exist in those places. Can you clarify that for our audience? What would make this different than the situations in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere?
It's a much more complex country. It's a much more complex regime. It's got many pillars to it. They have prepared for succession. They have been re-energized by the martyrdom of Ali Khamenei, as his followers see it. As I was saying earlier, this was a regime which kind of ideologically felt spent and has somehow been revived through the killing of its leader. The notion of martyrdom drove Iran in its to risk the lives of hundreds of thousands of its own people, send them to their deaths over 8 years. And I think Iran is and its regime of fighting for the survival, not just of the regime or the Islamic Republic. They're sort of somehow in their own eyes sort of fighting to show that America is not going to be the dominant power in the region, that it's not going to be able to decide which leader should be decapitated and which not. I think there's great concern in the region over a prospect of Israeli hegemony, which might follow. And this was a president who, you know, likes quick wins, who said that he wasn't going to get embroiled in the Middle East, and they want to show that perhaps by sucking him in, This is going to undermine America's credibility in the region. Mm. It isn't just Iran that's fighting this war, and many others are looking at what is happening and looking at, you know, look at China, look at Russia, the degree to which America could be sucked in and might not be able to determine the outcome. It's easy to start a war, much harder to end one.
Yeah, let me bring in another caller. We have Akram from Philadelphia on the line. Akram, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, good morning. I have two very quick comments. As somebody who lived through the Iraq War, I grew up in Iraq. I remember that the promise that we were given was not delivered, and we ended up with a very fragile democracy that is full of corruption. So I think something similar will happen here if regime change ends up being the end goal here. That said, my second point, and I want the listeners to really like try to balance those two conflicting points. That said, I don't know anybody who is mourning the death of the Ayatollah. He was an oppressive, theocratic dictator who hurt the Iranian people and the surrounding countries, including my home of Iraq, for close to 40 years. The people of Iran deserve better. I pray to God that they will get somebody better. I don't know if they will, but time will tell. Thank you.
Thank you, Akram.
Thank you, Akram.
From Philadelphia, on that line, that personal story there, very powerful. I want to sort of expand from there because I want to talk about what this means for the Iranian people and also what this means for the American people. And Jack, I want to start with the American people because, you know, this is something that clearly Americans did not want to see happen. And we're dealing with a lot of things domestically as far as affordability. What will be the impact potentially if this turns out to be a protracted involvement for our country?
Well, I think the president has said it himself. I mean, we've already seen four American troops, American service members dead in a drone attack in Kuwait. Iran still has retaliatory capability within the region. They have a very large magazine of ballistic missiles they can use in the region, of medium range missiles, of drones. That all becomes a possibility. And you have the largest U.S. military buildup in the region since the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. So there's just a significant risk factor for the American service members downrange. We heard Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying that there will be more U.S. service members coming. So that's a lot of people in harm's way and a lot of risk for the American public.
But also economically, could there be even more risk and impact that is felt across the country, Jack?
Yeah, I mean, we still don't know what the costs of the operation will be. They'll be quite significant when you're talking about multi-million dollar interceptors, right? Every time the Iranians throw up a drone or throw up a missile, the U.S. has to respond with air defense. That is a very expensive cost. So you're looking at billions and billions of dollars that will be spent on this operation and potentially the most eye-popping Pentagon budget in some time, a $1.5 trillion budget that's being discussed. So you're looking at an upward curve under this administration of higher defense spending and perhaps more protracted operations here.
And of course, great concern about global oil supplies as well. Stewart says there comes a time when good people must stand up against tyrants, regardless of the downsides, speaking in support of this strike. Caroline from Philadelphia says the Ayatollah was a horrible leader and no one to mourn, but his regime is still in power and shows no signs of relenting. All these strikes really did was further destabilize the region. Jack, I wanted to ask maybe a broader question about military strategy here as we get ready to wind down the hour. We've seen now the removal of a leader in Venezuela. We've seen the killing of a leader in Iran. And we should note lots of other high-ranking Iranian officials and high-ranking officials in proxy armies and militias around the region. This has now been going on for years. It seems to be strategic. If you can take out enough leaders, you can effectuate change. Does that mean, Jack, that we should expect more operations like this all around the world led by America, targeting specific people, specific leaders in quick strikes?
Well, the interesting thing that the U.S. is trying to square is they're not taking the strikes against Iranian leaders in these operations. They're targeting military installations, they're targeting air defense, but of course they gave the intelligence to give to the Israelis to launch that strike that killed, of course, Ayatollah Khamenei on Saturday. So You do see much more American involvement. We saw that in the Maduro case. That might have been more of a one-off. But, I mean, this is very, very unusual territory that we're in. In 2 months, two heads of state are gone from across the world, and America does have a hand in it.
And as we get ready to wrap up here, Nick, let's look forward. And if we could imagine that indeed this particular stage of the conflict lasts less than 2 months, do you think there is a decent likelihood of a significant change either in the posture of the regime in Iran or in the possibility of an entirely new regime in Iran? Or would you say at this point, those are remote possibilities? We have about a minute left.
I think a lot of that is going to come down to who inside Iran has the upper hand. Is it going to be the pragmatists who were in the process of looking at some form of transition, looking towards some form of greater kind of representation, perhaps in conjunction with some elements of the opposition outside and the constituent assembly, which could lead to some form of democracy, or will it be the ideologues? The ideologues very much look to be on the back foot. There was this kind of revulsion, as Akram was saying, of dictatorship. And yet what the war has done, I think, is to re-energize the ideologues and make them the front runners now to determine what happens in Iran. Mm.
Well, we will be watching closely over the weeks, months, and yes, likely years to come. Let me thank our guests, Nick Pelham, the Economist Middle East correspondent. Nick, thanks for being with us the whole hour here on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And Jack Detch, defense reporter for Politico. Appreciate your time today, Jack.
Thank you.
And want to say thank you to Gabriel from Newcastle, Delaware, and to Joe from Germantown. Sorry we didn't get to your calls today. And thank you to everybody who wrote in today. Lots of very thoughtful emails and communications. We appreciate that. And of course, we got to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks, Satina Calique, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We'll talk to you tomorrow.